Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. This is a prose verse again. It's a short one, so you know they wrote it on the board. But it's not like a regular verse that you chant with four lines. So I'll read the Sanskrit. Kovaiha te parijito parajitaya mayayana vasita padar yanan anavrita matir vishaya visha rayana vrita prakritir anupashita mahatcharanaha. And the translation by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Dear Lord, unless one worships the lotus feet of great devotees, one will be conquered by the illusory energy and his intelligence will be bewildered. Indeed, who has not been carried away by the waves of material enjoyment, which are like poison? Your illusory energy is unconquerable. No one can see the path of this material energy or tell how it is working. Purport. Maharaj Nabi was inclined to performing great sacrifices for begetting a son. The son might be as good as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, but such a material desire, be it great or insignificant, is brought about by the influence of Maya. A devotee does not at all desire anything for sense gratification. Devotion is therefore explained as devoid of material desires, anyabhilashita shunyam. Everyone is subjected to the influence of Maya and entangled in all kinds of material desire, and Maharaj Nabi was no exception. Freedom from Maya's influence is possible when one engages in the service of the great devotees, Mahatcharana Seva. Without worshiping the lotus feet of a great devotee, one cannot be freed from Maya's influence. Srila Narottam Das Thakur therefore says, Chadiya Vaishnava Seva, Nistara Payachikepa. Who has been freed from Maya's clutches without serving the lotus feet of a Vaishnava? Maya is aparajita, and her influence is also aparajita. You know, that means it can't be defeated. As confirmed in Bhagavad Gita 7.14, Daiviyesha Gurumayi Mamamaya Dharatyaya. This divine energy of mine, consisting of the three modes of material nature, is difficult to overcome. Only a devotee can surpass Maya's great influence. It was no fault on Maharaj Nabi's part that he wanted a son. He wanted a son like the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is the best of all sons. By the association of the Lord's devotee, one no longer desires material opulence. This is confirmed in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Madhya Lila, Chapter 22, Text 54. Sadhu Sangha, Sarva Shastra Khoi, Lava Matra Sadhu Sange, Sarva Siddhi Hoi, and Madhya Lila, Chapter 22, Text 51. Mahat Kripa Vina Kon Karme Bhakti Naya, Krishna Bhakti Duridahu Samsara Nahek Chaya. If one is serious about escaping Maya's influence and returning home, one must associate with a sadhu devotee. That is the verdict of all scriptures. By the slight association of a devotee, one can be freed from the clutches of Maya. Without the mercy of the pure devotee, one cannot get freedom by any means. Certainly, a pure devotee's association is necessary in order to obtain the loving service of the Lord. One cannot be freed from Maya's clutches without Sadhu Sangha, the benediction of a great devotee. In Srimad Bhagavatam 7.5.32, Prahlad Maharaj says, Naisham Matis Tavar Uru Kramangrim, Sprashatyanartop pagamo yadartaha. Mahi yasam pada rajo bishekam nishkinchana anam navranita yavat. One cannot become the Lord's pure devotee without taking the dust of a great devotee on his head. Pada rajo bishekam. A pure devotee is nishkinchana. He has no material desire to enjoy the material world. One has to take shelter of such a pure devotee in order to attain his qualities. The pure devotee is always free from the clutches of Maya and her influence. Om Gyanantimarandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurud Militanyena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shri Vasudhi Gaur Bhaktivinoda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare. The importance of serving a pure devotee is being stressed here by Srila Prabhupada in this purport. Typically, this devotee is the spiritual master. Yasya prasada bhagavat prasado, yasya prasada nagati gatopi. Without pleasing the spiritual master, one cannot please Krishna. By pleasing the spiritual master, one pleases Krishna. We sing this every day in the prayers to the spiritual master. And Krishna himself confirms that one who considers himself my devotee is not my devotee, but one who considers himself the devotee of my devotee, that is actually my devotee. Das, 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 anudas. In the spiritual world, this mentality is there. One devotee considers himself or herself the devotee of another devotee. And in that way, this mentality pleases Krishna. So it's not that in joining the Krishna consciousness movement, we have just joined some sort of club and our advancement in that club is not simply dependent upon our own abilities, our own advancement. There is also this factor to consider that one has to somehow or other please the spiritual master, please a great devotee of the Lord. And that is the actual measure of success. That is the price one pays for entrance into the association of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It is not just a matter of one's increasing one's own qualifications in some impersonal sort of way. It is not simply that one can just start studying different Vedic literatures and mastering different points of philosophy just in terms of one's own personal advancement. One somehow or other, by one's activities, one has to satisfy the desire of the spiritual master who can exist in the form, many different forms. There are instructing spiritual masters. There are initiating spiritual masters. There are all kinds of spiritual masters. So somehow or other, one has to satisfy the desires of a spiritual master. Of course, in our International Society for Krishna Consciousness, Srila Prabhupada made it quite clear that he wanted to be known as the founder, Acharya, of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. He insisted on that title because he wanted the society to remain faithful to his vision for spreading Krishna consciousness. So we also have to take that into account. In performing our activities, we should try to be satisfying, consciously satisfying desires that Srila Prabhupada had. And these desires are being satisfied by Srila Prabhupada's followers in disciplic succession. That is their qualification, that yes, they tried to satisfy his desires, just as he tried to satisfy the desires of his spiritual master, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, who very much wanted to see Krishna consciousness spread throughout the world in modern languages like English and German and other languages. So somehow or other, yeah, we have to be motivated in that way. Not that we're simply trying to advance our own careers in Krishna consciousness. Rather, we are trying to satisfy the desires of our founder acharya, of our other spiritual masters who are following in the footsteps of Srila Prabhupada, and that is, you know, the actual success in our lives. So otherwise, it's not possible to overcome the influence of Maya. Daivi esha gunamayi mama maya duratiya mame vaya papadyante mayamitam duratite. So Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita that his material energy, maya, it's very powerful, it's very difficult to overcome, but he says by surrendering to me, one can overcome it. But one cannot directly surrender to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. You know, Krishna explains in the Gita, evam parampara praptam, imam rajarsha yogadu, that this knowledge is received through disciplic succession. And the practice of devotional service, the practice of surrendering to Krishna, must be carried out under the guidance of a spiritual master who is in the disciplic succession, tadvadi pranipatena, Prayaprasnena Sevaya, Upadekshanti Te Gyanam, Gyaninas Tatvadarshinaha. So one must find a representative of Krishna, a bona fide representative of Krishna, surrender unto that personality, inquire submissively, and render service. And in this way, one can get a glimpse of the absolute truth. It isn't simply by one's own qualification that one can do this, one's independent qualification. The surrender to a devotee of Krishna must be there, a desire to please to please that representative of Krishna must be there. It is not that one can proudly impress Krishna with one's qualifications as a scholar or administrator or somebody who's competent to accumulate great wealth or whatever. One cannot please Krishna simply by one's own expertise. One has to become expert in satisfying the desire of a devotee of Krishna, a representative of Krishna. Of course, in our society, there are many, you know, representatives of Krishna, and it requires some expertise, you know, how to please those different representatives of Krishna, whether it's whether we're talking about one's Diksha Guru or Shiksha Guru or bona fide authorities who've been empowered, you know, by Srila Prabhupada to conduct the affairs of the society, like temple presidents, GBC, and so forth. Sannyasis also, you know, have been given authority by Srila Prabhupada. So somehow or other, we have to please our authorities. Srila Prabhupada in his purport is quoting the Chaitanya Charitamrita, and that book was written by Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami, but why did he write that book? He didn't write it because one day he decided, he got up in the morning, decided, yeah, I want to impress the devotees with my knowledge of Lord Chaitanya's pastime, so I'm going to become a great author. I'm going to write this book, Chaitanya Charitamrita. And no, it didn't happen like that. He was ordered by the great devotees in Vrindavan to please write this book. His spiritual master instructed him, other leading devotees in Vrindavan instructed him, please, please write a book in which you will explain to us the later pastimes of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So he wrote the book not to become a great author in his own estimation, to impress the Society of Devotees in that way. No, he wrote because the Society of Devotees asked him to write. So this is the mood of a devotee. Sometimes a devotee may have some inspiration to do something, but then such a devotee will approach the senior devotees and request permission to perform some service. But independently, devotees don't act on their own. We're meant to exist in a society of devotees. Tandara Charana Seva Bhakti Sani Vas. Our acharyas have sung. We are meant to exist in a society of devotees, and our activities should be done for the pleasure of the society of devotees and with the permission of the society of devotees. This is the ideal situation. So these things are being mentioned by Srila Prabhupada in his purport. And if we have some desire to serve Krishna, we should be thinking also how that service should be done within the Society of Devotees in a way that's pleasing to the Society of Devotees and is authorized by the Society of Devotees in which we find ourselves. And that way we can really please Krishna. Yasya prasada bhagavat prasado. So I'll stop there. Does anybody have any questions or comments on these points? Yes, Bhrigupati.
Chain of command. That's the way I've understood it. So
the question is, if you're pleasing your immediate authority, can you be sure that you're pleasing your spiritual master? And I would say, in an ideal situation, yes, that is how it should work. Of course, every situation may not be an ideal situation. So these things have to be carefully considered among the Society of Devotees. The Society of Devotees should be arranged in such a way that actually would be the case. But there can always be exceptions to the ideal situation. I mean, in the spiritual world, for example, like if you go there, if you study books like Ujjvala Nilamani by Rupa Goswami and other such books, you'll see that you won't be just directly relating to Krishna. You'll be placed in a group of devotees, a group of gopis, cowherd boys, even cows, in which there are authorities. There are authorities and sub-authorities. There are leaders. There are subgroup leaders. There are leaders in training,
And any devotee who goes into Krishna's Nitya Lila will be placed in such a group where there are leaders, sub-leaders. And, of course, the ideal situation there, and in the spiritual world it is the ideal situation, that yes, by pleasing your sub-leader, or you'll be pleasing your leader, you'll be pleasing Radharani, you'll be pleasing Krishna. So it should be like that. Of course, this is the material world, and the ideal situation may not always be present here, but if things are arranged in an ideal way, yes, by pleasing your immediate leader, your sub-leader, you could say, you're pleasing the leader of your group who is pleasing Krishna, and that's the way it should be in an ideal situation. But the idea, as I said, the ideal situations may not always apply here, so that some adjustments may have to be made, in the association of devotees to try to bring things more towards what the ideal situation should be. One more comment or question on this? Okay. If not, some devotees have asked me to give a report about my latest travels in India, so I'll do that at this time. Okay, so I just returned a couple of days ago from about a six-week tour of India where I spoke at about 50 universities and scientific institutions. And this tour that I just got back from, well, of course, it's based on the principle that's mentioned in today's verse, trying to please one spiritual master, satisfy some desire that the spiritual master had. So Srila Prabhupada said here in Los Angeles once, the more we kick on Darwin's face, the more advanced in spiritual consciousness. So, I've taken that very seriously. And I've tried to satisfy this desire of Srila Prabhupada as best as I can. But this current tour that I'm on, it actually had its beginnings in December when I spoke at a conference called Science and the Spiritual Quest that was organized by the Bhaktivedanta Institute in Trichy, South India. That's where Sri Rangam is. And there were about... Well, I was speaking about my book, Human Devolution, a Vedic Alternative to Darwin's Theory. And there were about 500 science professors and science students from universities all over India at this conference. And many of them are devotees, and many devotees are professors at various universities and scientific organizations around India. So they were asking me, can you come and speak? Make this kind of presentation at our university, at our scientific institution. So I told them they should get together among themselves and make some kind of plan. So they did that. So they invited me to come again to India, and I did that in March. I mean, after this conference in Trichy was very nice. They also had some cultural events there, like Bharatanatyam dancing. Usually here in the West, when we see such things, they're done with tapes. There's a dancer, but there's tape music. But there they had the original live music. And there was one very interesting dance, like a peacock dance, which I thought was really interesting. It was like, it was kind of interesting. So this conference was held here in Trichy in South India. And then after that, I didn't want to go back to the United States just after staying in India for 3 days. So I took the chance to visit some of the places that were visited by Lord Chaitanya in his South India tour, like Madurai, Rameshwaram, and Kanyakumari, which is in the very southern tip of India. And as part of the conference, we were also taken to the Sri Rangam Temple, where we got darshan of the Ranganath deity. That was nice. And then, as I said, I went to some other places, like the Manakshi Temple in Madurai, which was visited by Lord Chaitanya. This is a festival they were having at night there. Visited the Rameshwaram Temple, which is the place from which Lord Ramachandra went to Sri Lanka and then to defeat Ravana and then came back. And according to the account there at the temple, Sita, Ram worshipped a Shiva Lingam there. And this is the temple. It has 1,000 pillars. And then from there I went to Kanyakumari, which is at the very southern tip of India. Lord Chaitanya also visited this place. That's the Kanyakumari temple. And one interesting thing I saw in Tamil Nadu, southern India, were these big wind-powered electric generating fields. There are just thousands and thousands of these generators. They're generating power from wind, which is pretty interesting. So then in March, I went back to India to go on the tour that the devotees had organized. It started in Pune, went to Belgaum, then Bangalore, then to Palani in Rajasthan, then to Chandigarh, and then Amritsar, and then Delhi, Varanasi, and then some places in this area, Tata Nagar, Rourkela, Bhubaneswar. So I stayed 2 or 3 days in each place, and there were many lectures arranged in each city, but I'll just mention some of them. This was the University of Pune. As usual, students had lots of questions. They bought lots of books. I met with some science professors at the University of Pune who want to invite me to speak at a science conference that's coming up later this year. Then I went to Belgaum. I lectured at a big hospital there, a medical college. This is the director of the institution showing me about how it's all laid out. They actually have an Ayurvedic clinic and Ayurvedic Medical Research Center at this hospital. It's a huge modern hospital, and they have research facilities. They have people from all over the world actually come to this place. It's the Prabhakar Kori Hospital, and in front there's this statue of Dadvantari, who was the incarnation of Krishna that was famous for his medical activities. So Dadvantari is there. And the director of the whole institution introduced me to the whole medical faculty and the medical students that are there. So that was nice. He's a very nice man. It's one of the devotees from the Belgaum Temple who helped organize this event. Of course, I also spoke at the temple there. Then I went to Bangalore and spoke at the Indian Institute of Science, which is the top scientific institution in India. And I also spoke for scientists from the Defense Research and Development Organization in Bangalore. Then I went to Rajasthan to the Birla Institute of Technology there. And Palani, it's at a place called Palani. Palani's a little village out in the middle of nowhere in Rajasthan, so I kind of wondered why this institution had been built there. And it turns out that Palani is the home of the Birla family. It's the village that they're from. So they, so the founder of their Birla dynasty, you know, built this institution there. And it's interesting. There's a Saraswati temple, you know, the goddess of learning, a temple to the goddess of learning that's part of the university. And there's a museum there of science and technology. And I was sort of interested to see they had a section about UFOs, you know, Vimanas, you know, spacecraft, you know, from that are mentioned in the ancient Indian literature. So I thought that was kind of interesting that they did that. This Dr. Manoj Kanan, he's a devotee, and he was the main organizer of the tour. He's a professor, you know, at this university. At universities all over India, you know, there are devotees who are professors. It's, you know, very amazing. And they were very helpful in arranging this whole tour. Also in Palani, I spoke at the Central Electronic Engineering Research Institute, which is part of the Council of Scientific and Industrial Research, which is the main scientific research organization for the Indian government. It has about 30 different institutes scattered all over the country, and this was one of them. So it was another opportunity to speak to scientists. Then I went to Chandigarh. I spoke at Punjab University, the Department of Anthropology there. This is the head of the department. Typically, you know, in all these Indian institutions, they're very formal in the way that they receive, you know, guest speakers. You know, you always get some garland or some gift, and you're and then I had a free weekend in Chandigarh, so devotees took me to Kurukshetra, which is nearby, and this is the place where the Bhagavad Gita was spoken. And ISKCON also has a center at Kurukshetra. Srila Prabhupada wanted a big center developed there, but it hasn't developed in a grand scale yet, but ISKCON does have a center at Kurukshetra. And then devotees took me to Rishikesh, where I had a chance to, you know, refresh myself by bathing in the Ganges, and saw the Ganga Puja there every night. They have a very elaborate puja to the Ganges River. Then it was back to Chandigarh, to the Government Medical College there. As I said, these lectures, they're very formal. You know, there's usually you're asked to light, you know, a lamp, you know, to Saraswati, the goddess of learning, there. And, you know, it was another chance to speak to a lot of doctors and medical professionals. Then I went to Amritsar, which is in northern Punjab. I spoke at the Government Medical College there. There are lots of Sikhs in Punjab, in the northern part of Punjab. And this particular lecture was just packed with just hundreds and hundreds of students and teachers. You know, they were sitting in, they filled up every available space, and there were just about 200 students that wanted to come and hear the lecture but couldn't, you know, because the hall was just completely filled. Then I spoke at the Guru Nanak Dev University in Amritsar. And here again, they're preparing a traditional, you know, welcome. And as you can see, there are lots of Sikhs here. And actually, on one of the free days, you know, I visited the Golden Temple, which is the most sacred place for the followers of Sikh religion. So that's the Golden Temple in Amritsar. And then, you know, I spoke at the National Dairy Research Institute in a town called Karnal. And And then I spoke at the Delhi College of Engineering, gave a formal seminar there. And, you know, I had a long conversation with the director of that college, Dr. Sharma, and he recorded it, and he's going to publish it. He's going to publish the conversation in a publication, educational publication in India. And during one of the free days in Delhi, the devotees took me to Vrindavan. This is the Samadhi of Bhakti Swarup Damodar Maharaj at Radhakund. There's a Manipuri temple there that a Manipuri king gave to him. And this is looking out the front door. Yeah, you can see Radhakund there. Then I went from Delhi to Varanasi. I spoke at Banaras Hindu University, the engineering college there. And during one of the free days I had at Varanasi, the organizers of the tour took me to Sarnath, which is a place where Buddha began his teachings in India. Of course, we understand Buddha to be one of the avatars of Krishna. So this is where he began his teachings. And then I spoke at the Banaras Hindu University Medical School. That's the director of the school next to me. And then I went to some places in eastern India. This is the National Institute of Technology in Tatanagar, which is in Jharkhand state. And in this Jharkhand state, they've got a Maoist insurgency going on. You know, there's actually fighting going on inside India. So I was a little worried coming to this place. You know, I asked the devotees who are there, are there any Maoists at this college? And they said, well, last year there were, but they're not here now. I was kind of worried. You know, they might want to kidnap some American or, you know, do something like that. But they call them, the devotees call them Maovadis. Like there's Mayavadis, there's Maovadis. So from Tatanagar, I went to Rourkela, which is in Orissa. There's another National Institute of Technology there. And then finally, I went to Bhubaneswar, and I spoke at the Konark Institute of Technology. And they gave me this nice little juggernaut as a token of their appreciation. But I'm very happy to be back here in New Dwarka. Okay. Okay. Any questions about this? Yes, Maharaj?
One of these colleges that you go to?
Yes, they do. A lot of them paid for my travel to their college. You know, they paid for the air ticket or the train ticket to the school. Many places they put me up in the university guest houses, which are very elaborate places. You know, they give you a very formal welcome. You know, and many of them also paid honorariums, not big honorariums, but they paid something. So, yes, I was paid by these educational institutions to speak against Darwinism. And that, you know, that felt really good. I mean, sometimes they would give, the honorariums weren't what you would consider big honorariums, but they did give money. And they did, you know, provide me with accommodation and pay for the travel there. So yes, they did, many of them. Yes. There was a very good reception, and I've received letters from scientists who were present at the lectures, who've written back to me and said they very much appreciate what I'm doing. They One of them said, I went to a science conference and I tried to introduce, you know, some of your ideas there. And as I said, the head of this college in Delhi, he's going to publish my conversation with him in an academic publication there. So, yes, they are kind of picking up many of the schools. You know, they, of course, they bought books to put in their libraries. You know, I've made some suggestions about how alternatives like this should be part of the official curriculum, and many of them are favorable to that idea. Of course, India is the home of the Vedic culture. I'm offering a Vedic alternative to Darwin's theory, so there, since many of the people in India, including the scientists, they still have some sentiment. You know, although they, you know, to advance in their careers, you know, they may have had to go along, you know, with what the normal scientific view is on these questions. Within their hearts, they still have some affection for, you know, the Vedic culture. So, if we're able to. Many times what they try to do is they try to compartmentalize. You know, in their personal life, they'll maintain their Vedic ideas, and in their scientific work, they kind of conform a little bit. So what I've tried to do is break down that compartmentalization and get them to try to bring their Vedic ideas not just into their personal lives, but into their scientific work as well. Arjuna?
Yes, well, thank you again for taking the time. Many of the devotees may not realize, but it does take quite a bit of time to put together a presentation like this.
It does.
I'm always very appreciative that you do that. Two things. Did you encounter any notable opposition on this tour, or is everybody laying down? So that would be one thing. And then the second question would be, you said there are many devotees who are now professors in institutions there. How are they faring? Are they able to openly show their Krishna consciousness, or do they have to also compartmentalize?
On many of these campuses, there are lots of devotees who are students and professors, so they formed associations, you know, where they have regular meetings among themselves, either weekly or even daily. And in some places, they've established houses where the students who are into Krishna consciousness live together. It's like ashram. It's like an ashram. You know, there may be 10, 20 students who are into Krishna consciousness who live together. They have a morning program. They chant their rounds. They take prasadam. And then 8 o'clock, they go to their classes. So it's pretty amazing. And they are open. They are able to be open about their association with ISKCON. Many of the directors of the schools, they have some association with ISKCON. You know, for example, at one college I spoke at Pune, the director was a life member of ISKCON. You know, so he appreciated. So there's, in India, ISKCON has penetrated into many different areas of society. Of course, they're the wealthy people, the industrialists. You know, we've kind of penetrated that area, but there's also been some penetration into the you know, the academic and scientific realm as well. And your first question, no, I didn't really encounter much, or hardly any, you know, intense opposition there. Although I think it must be there, because in India there are many scholars are influenced by Marxist ideas, and they are very resistant to any kind of Hindu resurgence or Vedic resurgence in India. They want to keep things strictly secular, strictly scientific in the atheistic and materialistic sense of the word. So there are such personalities there, but I didn't encounter them. I guess the closest it came that came to that was at the Indian Institute of Science in Bangalore. In the audience, there was one senior professor there who just, at the very end, just walked out, you know, making some negative comment. But he really wasn't, you know, challenging in any way, you know. But, you know, I guess as a sign of protest, he, at the end, he made some angry comment and walked out. But other than that, I really didn't encounter any big opposition. Yes, Prabhu?
Your presentation was basically in Darwinism and addressing scientists, I assume natural scientists. Did you have, did you find there was a field of other academic disciplines who attended and were appreciative at all?
Well, I was, if you notice the different schools that I was speaking at, many times the audiences were engineers. Many times the audiences were medical doctors. You know, I did speak at some anthropology departments where there were sometimes some archaeologists present. But the audiences were varied, and they're very interested in, I found them to be very interested in a Vedic alternative to the Darwinian theory of evolution. And as part of my presentation, I was always saying that these kinds of alternatives should be part of the official science curriculum. That, yes, most scientists today accept the Darwinian theory of evolution. So, yes, their ideas should be taught. But there's a minority of scientists who don't accept the theory, and their ideas should also be included in the curriculum. You know, in, at least in some, I propose 5% of the textbook pages and 5% of the classroom time should be dedicated to these alternatives. And they liked that idea very much because they said, yes, when I was being educated, I only was exposed to these views, the Darwinian views. So, but yes, I mean, to answer your question briefly, many different audiences, many different kinds of academics and scientists were attracted to come to the lectures and hear them. Okay. Okay, Maharaj.
Just one more. How is the alternative view opposing Darwinian theory of evolution, how is that faring in America? Are there some places where they are allowed to have opposing views?
There's kind of a intellectual dictatorship sort of going on where the majority of scientists who support the theory of evolution have been able to convince the federal judiciary and other key elements of society to support only their ideas. It's now illegal to present any alternatives in any science classroom in the United States. And I think this is something that has to change. I think it's a key to this whole, because, and I think the reason why they keep alternatives like intelligent design and different creationist ideas out is because they understand as soon as you let them in a little bit, they will gradually increase in influence. So thus far, the Darwinist scientific establishment in America and in practically every country in the world has been able to exclude alternatives from the official science curriculum. And that's still the case, as far as I know. But 80% of the American people don't accept the Darwinian theory of evolution. So there's sort of a contradiction there that eventually is going to have to be dealt with. I think the proper way to deal with it is to allow alternatives into the official science curriculum. And that eventually, I think, is going to happen. Okay, Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Yeah.